Hi, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Born to Talk radio show. And I have a wonderful guest joining me today. His name is Michael D'Angelo. He's the founder of a nonprofit called Rapid Fire Comedy. He's a stand-up comedian. He's a writer, and he is a Marine Corps veteran. And I'm just delighted to have you join me. Thanks for joining me today, Michael.
Thanks for having me, Marsha.
It's my pleasure. And it's funny how people get connected through other people, and that is exactly what happened with you and I. So if you could please just tell our audience a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, you started off by saying it perfectly. I'm a founder of a nonprofit. I run the Rapid Fire Comedy Tour, and I'm a comedian, and I'm a writer, and I'm a United States Marine. I've been living in Los Angeles for about 9 years now. I was born and raised in Las Vegas. Came out to Los Angeles to grow as a comedian. And I've been out here really developing and learning a lot about myself and about the art form. And I'm a bit of a, you know, I'm a bit of an adrenaline junkie. I love stand-up because it puts you in that high-pressure situation. And I enjoy the craft of it. I'm an obsessive person. I really get, when I find something I like, I go all into it, and that's what I'm doing with stand-up and writing and creating this nonprofit where I can go out and perform for the military and first responders and things like that. I'm like very driven. I'm not much of a take time off guy. I don't really take vacations.
Okay.
I love to work. And I love stand-up comedy. I love writing. I love being able to express ideas, and not just comedy. I mean, I write everything. I write poetry. I write smut. I write, you know, short stories. I write screenplays.
My goodness!
I'm very addicted to the process that is being able to take ideas, put them on paper, organize them, and mess them up, and get them good too.
Isn't it interesting how things have changed? Are you paper to pencil, or do you do this all on your computer?
I am a lot of paper to pencil, but during COVID, I actually taught myself how to type. So I type too, and I, you know, when you got to put things in script format, you know, or you want to organize it to send it to somebody, you create like a pilot or a pitch deck. You gotta
sure.
type it and get it clean. But for the most part, I'm pen to paper as things start out.
Right. That's really interesting. I'm always curious about people's background and how they get to where they got, because we're going to learn a lot about you. And I'm just curious, what was it like growing up in Las Vegas?
It was crazy.
Why?
It was very crazy. I was born and raised out there, and it was quite the city. You know, it's not like just a regular suburban city. You know, it's this entertainment city. You have this thing off in the distance. You know, you live out on the outskirts, but you can constantly see the strip. You see Las Vegas Boulevard. It's this thing in the back of your mind, this, you know, call it opulence, call it, you know, luxury and excitement. It's kind of always out there looming, and you're looking at it like, oh, that's, you know, one day maybe, you know, you always measure everything to that. You know, you're like, oh, that's what it's like to have everything and all the fun and all the excitement. And I grew up extremely poor in Las Vegas, so I was constantly, like, comparing myself to, you know, how much better things could be. So it was kind of difficult to always be looking at that. But that being said, I had a blast growing up in Las Vegas. My parents were struggling with their own problems, you know, between divorce and some drug use.
Oh,
and it made for me to be, like, a very independent kid. I was running the streets with my friends all the time, and I was definitely causing a little bit of trouble, but just enough trouble to where it was fun and exciting, but I didn't get into, sorry about that.
I was going to say, I hope the police aren't after you right now, my friend.
Yeah, I live in East Hollywood now, so that's just the sound of my people out here.
Okay.
But I caused a little bit of trouble in Las Vegas, and you know, I found community and like camaraderie and really brotherhood running around out in the streets with my friends out there. And I learned a lot about, you know, myself compared to all these other kids, not necessarily me being better than them in any way, but
sure.
Really learning that, you know, I was different in the way that I thought and the way that I caused chaos. My chaos was different. I was, because my parents were, you know, never, they weren't really there for me. I became very, very independent at an early age, and it separated me from the group in that I was not a control freak, but I was absolutely like, I wasn't willing to give up control in a lot of situations. You know, without even knowing it, I was setting boundaries in situations and with friends because I just kind of knew better. I grew up around, you know, addicts and people, adults that couldn't control their life. So I was never putting myself in a position where the kids around me were putting me in a position where I didn't have control, you know? So, like I said, got into chaos and trouble, you know, running the streets, running around the sewers in the dark and breaking into, you know, like vacant homes and stuff, running amok, you know, starting fires, breaking windows, crazy stuff, swallowing stuff for fun, just, you know, kid stuff.
And, do you have any brothers or sisters?
I have an older sister, but because our home life was so unstable, she's 6 years older than me. When she was 16, she kind of took off, you know, which similarly, you know, when I turned about 17, I decided to take off too, because I was, as I got older, you know, when you're a young kid, you're just kind of like, you know, small time stuff. You're getting into like little fights with your buddies, you're stealing candy bars, you know, you're doing simple stuff. But as we got older, I always craved like financial security and organization. Sure. And I wanted to like have control over my life. But a lot of my friends, they wanted to be gangsters. They liked the street. They wanted more chaos. And as we got older, the stakes got higher. You know, I turned 15, I got my work permit, went and got my first job, saved every check, bought my first car. And my friends started like stealing cars. They started selling drugs. They started carrying guns. They started getting into fights with grown men. They started going to juvenile hall. They started getting sent to youth work camps. They started going to jail. And then when I was 16, it kind of came to a point where on 4th of July one year, a friend of mine was getting jumped out in the street by adults. And I ran out there to go help him. And someone sliced my face open with a straight razor.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it almost killed me. I could have died. And luckily I did not. I got extremely lucky that it didn't, you know, it didn't damage any muscle tissue in my face. And it didn't kill me, you know, it didn't get me in the neck. It didn't blind me. And I got to walk away from it, and I started to have this moment of reflection where I was like, I have to get out of Las Vegas, or I'm going to go to jail, or I'm going to die. And that was kind of like my Vegas experience.
My goodness, not pleasant. Well, what made you join the Marine Corps?
Well, that was it. I kind of knew I had to save my own life. I have to get out of here. It was, you know, in Las Vegas, you get like, you can either like work construction, you can work in the hotels and the casinos, you know, nightlife, food and beverage stuff, you know, you can learn a trade. My dad was a tradesman, but I just felt like I had to leave the city for a little. I had to give myself space because I wasn't mentally able to separate myself from the people I was hanging out with. I just knew I had to like make a drastic change. So the middle of my junior year, I went to the office at the high school I was going to, and I got my transcripts, and I went down to the community college, and I gave my transcripts. I was like, I want to take my GED, and I took the GED, passed it. A couple weeks later, got the, you know, the little diploma, and I went to the Marine. I went to the Navy recruiting office, actually, and I was like, hey, you know, I want to be a Navy SEAL, blah, blah, blah.
Uh-huh.
They were like, we're not really taking GEDs right now. We put you on a wait list. And I was like, oh, no, man, I just left high school to do this. Like, I'm 17 years old, you know? Or I think at that time I was 16. I wasn't even 17 yet.
Huh.
And they were like, well, you know, the Army office is right there. The Marine Corps office is right there. Go check them out. So I went to the Marine Corps office, and they were like, yeah, we can work with you. And a year later, I joined the Marine Corps at 17.
Wow. What year was that, Michael?
2008. I was supposed to graduate in 2009, so I left a year early.
Wow, that's interesting. So 2008, you joined the Marine Corps, feeling that this would be the answer to the sort of chaos that you were living in, it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah, it was an escape, looking for like stability and some sort of refuge from the chaos that was my life. And, you know, I joined and I get into boot camp, and it was so interesting because my life was so chaotic before. The boot camp was like relaxing, you know, that you get three meals a day, you sleep in a bed every night. And I hadn't had that at all growing up.
Right.
We moved around a lot, homeless at times, not knowing where we were going to eat next, things like that. And getting into boot camp was like, oh, it was like relaxing. It was something I craved and didn't know I was going to get from the Marine Corps. It was very interesting. And then on my 18th birthday is the day I actually became a Marine, when we got to the top of the Reaper and they gave us our Eagle, Globe, and Anchors.
No kidding. So actually for your 18th birthday, you became, what would you say, an official Marine?
Yeah.
Wow. You'll never forget that day, will you?
No, yeah, it was. It's a day that'll live in infamy.
Exactly. I think I've heard that before. So now you're in the Marines. Is it 2009 or 8?
I checked in with my unit in 2009.
Got it. Okay, so you're in the Marines. Where did you get deployed?
Well, I got really lucky. You know, when I joined, I was gung-ho. You know, I was a young, dumb kid, adrenaline junkie, chaotic kid. I wanted to go to Iraq. I wanted to go to Afghanistan. I wanted to fight. I wanted to go be in the shit, you know?
Uh-huh.
And I got really lucky. You know, hindsight 2020, I ended up going to Central America the first time I left country. And it was beautiful. You know, I'd never left the country, let alone to, like, some incredibly exotic, you know, like jungle. It was
amazing. Where in Central America did you go, Michael?
To Belize.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it was my first time experiencing the humidity like that I knew of, anything like that, and it was incredible. The humidity in the regular world, it's hot, it's sticky, it's gross, you're sweaty. But when you're like working all day and like laboring, it's amazing. You know, your joints feel better, your lungs, your skin, you move better. I was thriving in it, and I loved running through the jungles and sleeping in the hammock, and it was incredible. It was beautiful. I got to get a lot of really good jungle warfare training under my belt, which led into me being able to go into Southeast Asia in 2011. I deployed to Southeast Asia because I had already been to the jungle once, and they were looking for, I was still a junior Marine. I was very low ranking, but they let me join this like cadre platoon of instructors because I had already gone to the jungle and had some experience there. And then Southeast Asia was even more beautiful. You know, we started out in Japan, which was incredible. The culture and just even the base that we were on in Okinawa was really nice. Our barracks was right out on the ocean. We spent about a month there kind of doing a workup, doing some jungle warfare training and playing around with the AAVs. And then we got on ship. We got on the USS Tortuga, which is like an LSD. It was the LSD 46, which I don't even, I'm 100% sure what that means. But basically, it's a big enough ship that they can load a bunch of these AAVs, which are amphibious vehicles. And basically, we spent the next like 6 months just practicing beach raids. You know, we went to Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, Korea, and every country we went to, we, you know, our ship would stop off of the coast, and our partner nations, you know, like the Malaysian Marines, the Thai military, they would come on ship and meet with us, and we would like develop like, you know, a training plan. And then we would get in these little amphibious assault vehicles and push off into the ocean, roll up to the beach, jump out, and then like assault up the beach, up into the jungle, and then bivouac and sleep in the jungle and do training exercises there. And it was awesome. It was like real Marine stuff. You know, the last 20 years, I mean, you know, 30 years, the Marine Corps has really been in the desert, in the mountains. And I love the mountains, but the Marine Corps was founded on like, you know, working for the Navy, jumping off the ship, going on, you know, raiding the beaches. And there's a lot of Marine Corps history, you know, from World War I, World War II, of coming off ships, landing on the beaches, and assaulting up and through into enemy territory. And it felt awesome to be able to learn those tactics and to experience, you know, not just those tactics, but like be in Southeast Asia where there's like tons of history of war and battle being fought there, and like to kind of stand in the places that a lot of people stood before you, and the culture. And it was beautiful. It was more humidity, loved being in the jungle. We got to do more jungle warfare training and do their obstacle courses in Japan. And I loved it. We broke some course records. I got to, what's funny is when we were in Japan, you know, they break you off into sticks, into like different groups of guys, and they are like leadership, you know, our battalion commander, company commander, the landing force commander, like coming around, watching all of us as we're working on our knots for the next day to do the course. And we found out that they were going to go out, like they were going to go and do the course with like a group of guys. And I told them, I was like, oh, I'm sorry, gentlemen, you're not going to be a part of the winning stick. And they're like, oh, you guys think you're going to win? And I was like, oh, we're definitely going to win. And then that the next morning before we pushed off, my team leader comes up and goes, good job, idiot. Now they're going to be in our stick. You're going to be their team leader. So I got to be the team leader for like all the brass as we pushed through the jungle. So we're like running through the jungle doing this obstacle course. And I'm like looking at this major, like the landing force command. I'm like, sir, where's your weapon? You got all your gear? You good to go? You drinking water? All right, let's go. Let's go. Push up. You're up here. Push up here. Push off to the left. Get down, you know. It was a lot of fun.
What was your level in the Marine Corps? What were you, what was that? I don't know how to use that. I don't know what word to use.
Rank, yeah. At that time, I was still just a Lance Corporal. I was an E3. I got out as a corporal. I got out as an E4.
Okay. And so how long were you actually in then?
5 years.
Okay. But you didn't go to war anywhere, right? I mean.
No, thank God. I got really lucky and I didn't have to go and put rounds down range.
Okay. Wow. So what did you do when you got out of the Marines?
Well, when I got out in 2013, the reason I got out was because my back got a little messed up. I basically started having some back issues that quickly like progressed to the point of like debilitating me, and they gave me the option. They were like, well, we can give you a new job or you can get out. And at that time the leadership in my unit was not great and I was kind of over it. So I was like, you know what? Just let me cut me loose. So they medically separated me. But here I was, you know, broken at 23 years old and not being able, you know, walking with a limp, being in pain every day, not being able to sleep, sometimes not being able to get out of bed.
Wow.
And I went into like, you know, I got into like a state of depression. I was scared. I was like, what am I going to do? I'm such a laborious person. What do I do
You're
now?
You're young.
Yeah. And I knew that I couldn't work hard physically like that anymore was kind of the thing. I was like, okay, I'm going to have to figure out what to do now. I have to pivot. And I assumed I was going to have to get into like white collar work. You know, I was like, oh, I'm going to have to learn how to like talk to people in like professional settings, you know, not just Marines. Yeah, it's a whole different ballgame. But I'd have to get into like sales or something, you know. But I wasn't confident, you know, explaining things or talking in front of people. You know, I was a very physical worker. So I had an idea. I was like, you know what I should do to get better at just like speaking and not being nervous? I should go to a comedy open mic because I had always been in the Marine Corps and even in school, you know, I was like always like telling jokes, kind of, I wouldn't say class clown. I wasn't that funny, but I had fun making my friends laugh. And like, I would always, you know, I grew up mostly, it was me and my dad and, you know, you hear bar jokes hanging out with your dad and his friends. And I would like try to remember them, you know, and I would write my own like silly stuff. And I've been obsessed with like writing since I was a little kid. Always written like short stories and fiction and crazy stuff. So I was like, I should take one of my notebooks, do an open mic, see how, you know, just check it out.
Right.
And I went. I went the same month I got out of the Marine Corps. I went down to an open mic, signed up, a little dive bar in Las Vegas called Meatheads. It's not even there anymore. Signed up and I did like 5 minutes and it was so wild because I got like a crazy adrenaline dump that I had never experienced before because, you know, my childhood was rough. I experienced a lot of like very stressful, very scary situations as a kid. And I've never been so scared that I almost pissed myself. And I was waiting to go up at this open mic. And there was like, you know, they tell you like, all right, you're in the hole or you're on deck, meaning like there's two people before you or there's one person before you or you're next. And I'm waiting to go up and they're like, all right, you're in the hole. There's two more comics and then you. And I'm like, okay, I'm waiting. I'm like, man, I got to go to the bathroom. So I go to the bathroom, I go pee. I come back and I'm watching. They're like, all right, one more and then you. And I'm like, okay. Oh, man, I got to pee again. And I go to the bathroom and I pee a little bit. And I come back and watch. And they're like, all right, you're next. You're next. Like 2 minutes, this guy's coming off stage. I'd be like, damn, why do I feel like I got to pee again? And
nerves.
Yeah, and I go up on stage, and I didn't like full out pee my pants, you know, but I go on stage and I can feel myself like peeing a little bit. I'm like, I've never been so scared that I lose bowel control. And I go up, I have a good set. I wouldn't have like this amazing, oh my God, that was so good. I'm gonna be a comedian. This is what I want to do, you know, but it was awesome. It was fun. It was an adrenaline rush. It was free. It was legal. I didn't get in trouble. Nobody got hurt. I was like, oh man, this is awesome. I like doing this. And that was kind of like my first experience of like, oh, okay, I think I like doing this. I never knew I could do this before. And you know, I used that platform to get me confident, and I did get into sales. I started working, doing sales in Las Vegas. I've got like a job at like a life insurance company, and did like a retail sales job, and I got into like telecommunication sales, and then I was doing like commodity sales, and it really helped me pivot coming out of the Marine Corps. You know, I got really busy with work and turned into a workaholic, and got confident in being able to talk in these professional settings.
So when you were first being that stand-up guy, and you were in Vegas at the time, who was your audience?
It's dive bars, you know.
Oh, so they're dive bars, okay.
Yeah, a lot of dive bar, a lot of just bars, you know, bar sports bars. People that are, I mean, one, they don't even know there's comedy going on that night sometimes. But even if they do, you know, there may be some drunks in there, some gamblers, people just, you know, bar flies, just, you know, classic bar scene.
Okay. So now you've jumped into the comedy world. Are there some comedians that you look up to?
There's so many comedians at that time, you know, I that was like very early on that I was listening. Once I started doing it, I really started to consume a lot of comedy. I started listening to a lot of guys on Pandora Radio, and you know, watching like Comedy Central specials, you know, before Netflix was a big thing. And I really fell in love with guys like Dave Attell, because he had a wild style of comedy. His stuff kind of was, he jumped kind of all over the place. It wasn't like this one big story where we tie it all back in at the end. It was just kind of like, here's a thing, here's another thing, here's this about this. You ever think about this? But then there were guys like George Carlin, who, you know, was like prolific in that he talked about like very important subjects, and his was less of like jokey joke setup punch and more of like monologues, almost like ballads, you know. And it really inspired a style of writing in me for comedy that was like, it opened, it gave me room to do whatever I wanted looking at guys like that, because it's easy to get trapped in that mindset of like, oh, it has to be like this, you have to write a joke like this. Like, no, there's not one way to do it, you know. You can go up there and just like tell a story, or you can just have an idea and explore it. And you know, over time, as you do it and you develop it, it becomes funny, as long as you keep that as your, you know, your guidepost out in the distance. So like Carlin, Attell, I really like Jeselnik, who is much more of like a setup punch, you know, like a very like setup and then turn. Definitely has like a rhythm to his that is more jokey joke, but he had like a dark style of humor that I really liked. And then, you know, Louis C.K., who is like just an incredible writer, an incredible performer. His ability to play the game on stage, to find the funny thing, and then to keep hitting it, to keep coming back to it, to act it out, to portray characters, to give these point of views that you just never, you don't get to, you don't think about, or you don't, no one talks about, you know. Really like ringing out comedy. Those were my real heroes in the beginning. And now, you know, living in LA, I have even more people that I look up to, just incredible people. Guys like Theo Vaughn, he really inspires me to like be myself. You know, Theo talks about when he first moved to LA, he kind of hid who he was. He tried to be like the people that were making it, you know. He tried to like make himself more like what he thought the industry wanted, and in doing so, he kind of hindered himself. He like got rid of his originality and his personality. And then when he finally did, things really like changed for him, and things like that kind of inspire me to stay true to my voice and just talk about what I want to talk about. And then guys like Andrew Santino, his ability to just, like, I don't know. He's probably my favorite comedian. I couldn't even tell you what it is exactly. He's just very good. He's very funny. I watch him on stage. Sometimes I'll be watching a show somewhere and he'll come on and I get, like, so excited to see him. I hear him start talking about new material I haven't heard before. And I get, like, this anxious excitement where I almost can't even be in the room. I'm like, oh, what's he going to talk about? Where's he going with it? What's he talking? Like, he's so good. I have so many heroes. Guys like Big Jay Oakerson, he's a very dirty comic. He does a lot of crowd work, but, you know, he found his audience. And that as a guy, my comedy is a little rough around the edges, a little wild. And it can be daunting in this world of, like, you know, clean comedy or you know, just what the culture wants and politically what's correct. And it's just...
Right.
It's nice to have heroes who made it work, and
you have to have a lot of confidence to be able to do this, don't you?
You think so, but there's also, you know, it's not. Sometimes you're not confident, but you do it anyways. You know, I'd say less confidence, more love of the game and courage. Really, you know, not necessarily having. You don't always feel confident, but you gotta have the courage. You know, you're scared as hell, but you do it anyway. You know, you're unsure, but you do it anyway because you love
it. Got it. And do you have somebody that helps schedule these places, or do you do this all yourself?
Yeah, I don't have any representation. I'm looking for an agent or a manager. That would be nice.
Okay.
But I'm a solo guy right now. I do it all on my own.
Got it. Well, then you're not paying anybody. There's the bonus. So you're in Vegas. But then you end up coming to L.A. So why did you move to L.A.?
Well, it was a move for growth. I started comedy in Vegas. And, you know, the first couple years I was just, you know, doing it for fun. I liked doing it. And at some point I was doing some sales and I was, like, working really hard. And I just kind of had this moment where I realized, like, man, I'm very disciplined. I'm very, you know, I'm very driven, I'm ambitious, and I'm working a lot of jobs doing things that I just don't care about, you know, which, like, you know, that's kind of life. Everybody has to work a job that they're not super interested in. You just do it because that's a job. That's how jobs work. But I kind of decided, you know, I should take this energy, all this debt, this hard work that I have, this natural, like, energy and ambition to, like, learn and to grow, and I should dump it into something that I like to do. And I that's when I was like, you know what? I'm gonna start doing stand up more. I'm gonna go after it. You know, I'm gonna try to, like, really, really put myself in all these, like, different scenarios, you know, take classes and do bigger shows and, like, put myself out there and fail and I wanna learn, I wanna get better at this, and I think I could, like, make a career out of it one day. So I like kind of quit a couple of jobs and got some other jobs that were lower stakes that I could take time off from if I needed to. And I just started doing shows every night, you know, whether it was open mics or bar shows or leaving town to do other shows. And I started coming to LA for about a year. I would drive out to LA once a week and I would sleep in my car for two nights. I would come out on Mondays and I would go to a show on Mondays at the Comedy Store called Potluck, which is like their showcase show. People saw, like, 200 people sign up. They put 15 people up, and then they put up all the door guys that work there, and then they put up, like, paid regulars, people whose names are on the wall that have been passed by the Comedy Store that are, like, you know, road comics, just people that are really good, been doing it a long time. And I would watch that show on Monday nights. Then I would sleep in my car, and then Tuesdays I was taking a writing class, or I was taking, like, an improv class. And then I would sleep in my car that night. And then Wednesday, I was helping a friend produce a show above a Hooters on Hollywood Boulevard. Mm. And I did that for about a year, just, like, you know, coming out, really just developing myself, you know, doing this show, taking these classes, watching at the Comedy Store. And I just kind of decided, I was like, you know what? I'm going to have to move to LA. Like, I kind of hit my ceiling in Vegas with, you know, like, you can perform at the casinos, but the casino residencies are for, you know, made men, you know, people who are kind of on the back end of their career. All the really good spots out there are for headliners, and I was not a headliner, you know. I was still, like, very new in comedy, and I kind of got to where I could get with comedy in Las Vegas, and watching all the stuff that I saw in LA, there was so many really good people, and I was like, I want to move out here and surround myself with that. I want to come out and like really be a part of this environment and push myself and you know, like just see what's possible and compare and be in a life of comparison and just seeing how good you can be. Mm-hmm. So I moved out, and at the time I owned a condo in Las Vegas, a small little condo. And I was like, you know what? I'm not going to pay mortgage in Vegas and rent in LA. That's crazy. But I don't want to live with like 10 dudes in LA. I don't want to do that. So I was like, I'm just going to live in my car. So I moved out to LA, and moved out in 2017, like April, I guess. Yeah, this month is a year. And I started, just living in the car, and I got hired like 4 days after I moved to LA. I got hired as a door guy at one of the comedy clubs. And it really put me in that environment where I was watching comedy every night, and it was exactly what I needed, exactly the plan to come out and to grow and develop myself.
You know, I haven't heard the term comedy store in a really long time. That is a physical location, am I right?
Yes.
And where is that located?
It's on Sunset Boulevard, kind of Sunset and like La Cienega.
So is that called Hollywood there?
Yeah, that's technically West Hollywood.
Okay. And so you performed at the comedy store? Is that what I understood you to say?
Yeah, I would do their open mic. A couple of like little shows. They have three rooms there, you know. They have like their original room, which is their front room, which is like, you know, a sacred room, and then they have the main room, which is their big, it's like the bigger space. It seats like 380 people.
Wow.
And then they have the belly room, which is like their smaller developmental room. It's upstairs. It seats like 70 people. I was getting like little spots here and there in the belly room, and I even got to do a really big show in the main room one time. It was a very short set, but yeah, I started doing like little spots there and getting to be a part of like the magic that is performing there.
And you did all your own writing. You didn't have somebody writing your comedy. You wrote your own comedy. Is that correct?
Oh yeah. Nobody writes for me.
Okay. Well, I mean, but that's you. There are comedians that do have writers for them. Am I right or am I wrong about that? I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, there's definitely people who do that.
Okay, I just was curious. I don't know anything about the industry. So you're writing your own comedy, and did you ever repeat what you did on a Tuesday and then do it 3 weeks later on a Thursday, or did you always have something new every time you were on the stage?
The goal is to always be kind of writing new stuff. That's the process, you know, to always have stuff in your pocket that you're working on.
And how long? I've never done this before. I would really like to know more about this. So now you're performing. So how long would you be on stage for when you're doing your act, so to speak?
You know, in LA, you're getting a lot of like very short sets, very, you know, showcase sets is what they're called.
So you're familiar with those terms, but we're not. So I don't know what a short set is.
So, you know, typically as a headliner, you know, when it's your show, you're doing 45 minutes to an hour. And that's what I'm working at now. You know, I go on the road about a dozen times a year to go headline and do those big sets. Typically, though, I'm usually like featuring. I'm doing like 20 to 30 minute sets, which is the person that goes up before the headliner. You're like the middle act.
Okay.
Those. But in L.A., the market is so full. There's so many comedians out here. There's so many really good comedians out here, and there's a lot of like industry out here. Everybody's trying to be seen. There's a lot of like opportunity. So it's real like there's just a lot of people and not a lot to go around. So there's a lot more like showcasing. There's a lot more short sets. You're on like lineups instead of a show that has like three comics on it, you know, your host that's doing 10 to 15, your feature that's doing 20 to 30, and then your headliner that's doing 45 to an hour. You'll be on shows in LA where there's like 10 comics and everybody's doing 10 minutes, you know, so there's a lot of like 10 minute sets, and below. Like, a lot of the open mics in LA are like 3 minutes. It's just enough time to go up and like work out new material, you know, which is great. It puts you in this space where you're constantly trying to get better in these small bite-sized chunks. And when it goes well, it's just like a little taste, you know, you're like, oh, that was like it, just enough excitement to like push you forward. Whereas, you know, if you're doing longer sets, you know, you might lull, you know, and that's part of it. But I kind of love the showcasing of it, because it really helps you build out a set. It helps you figure it out chunk by chunk, 7 minutes by 7 minutes, you know, and it's digestible. And as far as comedy goes, I watch a lot of it, and it can be difficult sometimes to try and sit through an hour and a half show and listen to, you know, only a few different comics do really long sets. You know, if the comedy's not super great, or if it's predictable, it can be boring. Versus a show that's got like 10 people on it and they're all different, you know, there's a lot of variety, there's a lot of diversity. And, you know, if you don't like somebody, it's fine. They're only up there for 7 minutes. There'll be someone else in a few minutes, you know, things like that. It's a different environment, but I like it.
Oh boy, I'll tell you, we're having one siren after another on this show. I don't know where you live, but we're certainly hearing them all. What was it? Oh my goodness.
It's almost passed. Hold on. Sorry.
I wish that there was a way we could maybe close a window or do something where you're living that could sort of
That's what the window closed, believe it or not.
Oh my gosh. Wow. But if you hear that in the middle, then I imagine this must be very difficult to sleep. So speaking about sleeping, it kind of takes me over to my other question, which was, what was it like living in your car in Los Angeles?
Well, in the beginning, it was extremely exciting, right? I moved to LA. I already kind of had some ground here. You know, I've been coming out for a year once a week, and so I already had like some friends. I had a show I was helping with. I was taking classes. So I kind of hit the ground running. But then 4 days after I moved to LA, I got hired as a door guy at a comedy club. And it was like one of the best, it wasn't the Comedy Store, it's the Hollywood Improv, but it was one of like the well-known clubs, a pretty big club, you know, a lot of big, great people perform there, you know, and I'm like working there at night from like, you know, 7 to midnight to 2 a.m.-ish. And then I would get off work, and I got like a little retail job at a little snowboard shop, Burton Snowboards, I was working at during the day. So like I started this routine where, you know, I would work at the Improv from like 7 to 2, and then I would get off work, I would drive to Santa Monica, sleep in my car next to the gym, wake up at like 8 a.m., go to the gym, work out, shower, go to my retail job, work there for 8 hours, get off at like 5 p.m., drive back into Hollywood, and then work at the Improv that night. And then nights that I didn't work at the Improv, I was doing shows, I was doing open mics, and days that I didn't work at Burton, I would go down to Santa Monica, and I would plug in my speaker, and I would busk down there. I would just like, you know, do street comedy for people. So for like the first couple years, it was just like, I was just like getting developed, I was getting better, it was so exciting, I was doing everything I wanted to do, I'm in LA, the weather's beautiful, it was, you know, I'm flying by the seat of my pants. It was very, very exciting, very fulfilling. And I was getting better at comedy way faster. But by year three, my sleep started to suffer. I was very, it was
deprived.
Rough sleeping in the car. It was a lot of shoulder sleeping, a lot of rolling around. And then year four was great in that comedy was doing really well. I was way better at comedy. And I was getting more opportunities, more bookings. The show that I was helping produce finally got picked up, and so in 2019, we got our first date at the Comedy Store. We went from like, you know, in this little room above a Hooters to like the Comedy Store giving us a night in their small development room, the belly room, the little 70-seater. It was on a Sunday between Christmas and New Year's, and we sold it out. I got to host it, and it was an amazing show. Everything went great. We got our next date for April 2020, and then the country shut down in March 2020.
Huh. Well, then what'd you do?
Well, for a few days, I hung out with some friends, and we just, you know, did some drugs like a couple of artists, you know, and and I slept on a couch with my buddy. We hung out and chilled. But after a couple days of that, I was like, oh, I don't know, man. It feels like I'm just doing drugs now. I don't want to just be in LA doing drugs. I don't know when they're going to open everything back up. So I went back to Vegas. I was like, you know, in Vegas, if the clubs are all closed, everything's shut down, I might as well go back to Vegas. I can sleep in my own bed. At the time, my sister was renting a room from me, so I went home and saw her, and she was an excellent cook. So, like, I'm eating home-cooked meals. I'm sleeping in a bed every night. Just, like, really,
that's
like,
awesome.
Resting and recovering from
yes.
living in the car for so long. And then after about 5 months of being in Vegas doing nothing, I had like a nervous breakdown. I was like, what happened to all this momentum I built? Is it ever going to, like, are the clubs going to open back up? What do I do? Like, I can't just... You know, I'm such a worker, I couldn't take that much time off. It broke me. And I ended up getting a job at a casino in Vegas because the casinos kind of started, you know, they were still doing stuff. And I got a job doing security for a couple months, and my buddy found out. And he was like, what? No, man. Like, let's drive to Arizona. Let's go to Texas. Clubs are open in Arizona and Texas. So I quit the casino job after only like 2 months, and I went back on the road, and we did shows in Arizona and Texas. And then by then... the improv started opening back up, and they offered me my job back. So then I went back to LA, and it was like, you know, it was like temperature guns and 6 feet distance and you know, vaccine cards and masks and all that. So it was like, it was a different world, but that was kind of like the coming back from all of it.
So have you been all over the world with your comedy?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I haven't been everywhere, but it has taken me.
I'd like to hear about it.
I can tell you about one particular experience where I got to go out of the country to do comedy that was incredible, and it changed my life. And it was in 2019 for Edinburgh, for Fringe Fest. Do you know what that is?
No, I don't.
So in the UK, they have like a giant festival. It's like the big British arts festival. And a long time ago when they started that festival, a lot of people didn't get into it. You know, it's just the way it goes. You can only accept so many people. Well, the people that didn't get in were like, you know what? Fine. If we're the fringe, if we're the people that don't get in, we're the outsiders, we're going to start our own festival. And it's called Fringe, the Fringe Fest. And it happens every year for the entire month of August. Now they're all over the world. There's like one in Australia. They do it in LA. They have them everywhere now. But the first one, the original one, started in Edinburgh in Scotland. And a long time ago, I saw a comedy special by a guy named Hannibal Buress called 30 Days in Edinburgh. And it was him in Edinburgh, and he did an hour every night for 30 days, you know, running his hour, developing it. And I thought it was incredible. I was like, that sounds awesome. I would love to do that. I literally put it on a vision board one day, you know. So fast forward, I'm in L.A., like, living in my car, and I'm like, oh, man, I would love to go do that. That would be cool. But I was like, oh man, I don't know how to get booked there. I don't have representation. No one knows me. I'm not like a super funny, super talented comic. No one wants to book me. How am I going to go? And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to go. I'll just go 1 year, experience it, and then I'll meet people, know more about it. And then the following year, I'll probably get booked. So I'm just going to go. So I booked like my flight, my Airbnb. And like a few months before I left, a friend of mine that I worked with, she was like, oh, you're going? She's like, I have a show there. I have like 15 nights there. Do you want to open for me? And I was like,
whoa.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to, you know? So I, bam, picked up 15 spots. And then like a month before I leave, another comic that I know finds out I'm going. He's like, oh, you're going? I have a show every night at midnight. Do you want to open for me? I was like, yeah. So I just picked up 30 more shows there. And then I finally get to Edinburgh, and it's incredible. I've never been to Europe, let alone like this beautiful, very old city. And, you know, and there's this giant comedy festival going on. So it was just like this incredible experience that shocked me. And then when I get there, I'm like meeting all these other comics that I start getting other spots. I ended up opening up 3 shows a night for 25 days straight.
Man. And was it, let me ask you this, because you obviously know the answer and I don't. Was each show a whole different performance? I mean, were they the same things? Or did you?
They were stand-up shows. Well, my friend, the girl, the one that had 15 shows, the first person to offer me spots, hers was musical comedy. She, like, writes songs that are funny. But the other people, they were all just, like, stand-up shows doing, like, a one-man, one-hour show. I would just – the way it worked is I would help them bark for their show, and I would, like, bark for a couple hours, open that show for them, and then I would leave and go to the next show, bark for an hour or two.
Are you saying bark?
Oh, bark. Yeah, there's another term. It means like standing out on the street and like talking to pedestrians, being like, "Hey, we got a show. You want to come to the show? Here's a flyer." And I had, when I was in LA, that's what we did for the show that was at Hooters. It was right on Hollywood Boulevard. So we would stand out on the street and be like, "Yo, you guys like stand-up comedy? You want to come to a show tonight? This is what's going on. This is the time." And I had been doing that for like a couple of years already. So when I got to Edinburgh, it was kind of like my Super Bowl. I was already really good at like talking to people and promoting shows and flyering. And I helped people fill their rooms. And I got to open, I would do 10 minutes at the top of their show. And it was incredible. It changed me in comedy. It humbled me. It developed me, and it made me like it gave me a lot of perspective about, performing in general, because all the crowds, there's all kinds of different crowds in Edinburgh. You get like small crowds, you get big crowds, you get like foreign crowds, you get drunk crowds, just a lot of experiences that I had never gotten before. And it was awesome. It was exactly what I needed at that point in my life. In fact, when I left Edinburgh, I like started planning to come back and do my next year there. I booked like another flight in Airbnb for the next year, but then of course, because of COVID, they shut it down.
Well, I guess what I'm curious about, Michael, is that so you're on the stage Tuesday and you're performing. Now your next performance is Wednesday. Are you doing the exact same routine on Wednesday that you did on Tuesday for just a different crowd?
Not necessarily, and that's the beauty of it. Like, you have so much stage time that you get to like you can build a different set every night, and you're writing while you're there, so you're doing brand new material. You're not just talking about all your jokes that you have, but you're like talking about the city and experience. One night in my Airbnb, I came into my Airbnb and there was some dude in my bed, like all kinds of silly stories, things like that.
And so, do you write this down, or are you just, is this just strictly ad lib?
No, I'm a heavy writer. Some stuff's ad lib. When I get into a flow state, I ad lib, but I'm a big writer.
So are you writing ahead of time so that you know that on Tuesday you're going to say this for how long? 15 minutes on stage? I don't know how long the performances are.
Yeah, sometimes you write ahead for a particular show if you have a big spot or a big show, but usually it's night of, you're kind of building out, all right, tonight I'm going to do this.
But how long is the performance, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Well, when I was in Edinburgh, they were 10-minute sets.
Okay, 10-minute sets. So each night you would do a different set because probably you didn't have the same audience night after night, correct?
Yeah, I would do a different set a lot of the times.
Wow, so you were constantly, that's the writer in you. You were constantly developing new content, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. Well, I would really like to spend some time now talking about the Rapid Fire Comedy Tour because this is your .org, and I think this is really impressive. I'm so glad that we're going to highlight this. So let's talk about this. How did you start the Rapid Fire Comedy Tour and why?
Well, when I moved to LA, I came out here to get better, to develop. And once I moved out, I didn't get as much development as I thought I was going to get. The club I got hired at didn't have like a development program. Some clubs do, and that's basically where if you work there, they give you like spots on shows to help you grow and learn. And my comedy, being a Marine, coming from like a crazy childhood, and just, having more of an affinity for like a bluer or darker style of material in LA, and I was still new. I was only been doing comedy for like 4 years. I was still pretty green. I just wasn't, I came into this city with all these really great people, and I just didn't get as much stage time as I thought I was going to get. And it kind of like made me nervous. I was like, oh no, I moved out here, but I'm not getting the reps that I want. Like, I don't. This audience out here doesn't really met. They don't really like me. So what do I do? Like, who's my crowd? What should I do? And I realized that all my buddies in the Marine Corps were some of the people that told me, like, yo, you should do comedy, man. Like, if you don't like get into stand-up comedy or try that, you might be kind of wasting your talent, your life. You should try it. So I realized, like, okay, I'm in SoCal. Marine Corps base right out here. Pendleton's right here. I should reach out to some Marine stuff. And I at the time I hit up like the USO Tour, I hit up GIs of Comedy, Armed Forces Entertainment, a lot of groups that already do comedy for the military. But of course, the USO Tour is like this huge organization. They work with like stars, And then these other smaller groups, they kind of already have their roster. They have their like good old boys club, which understandably so. I have my group of people that I use now. But nobody really wanted to help me. So I was like, you know what? I'm just going to start my own thing. And I sent 400 letters out to Marine Corps units all over the country, really, but mainly targeting Southern California. And I was like, hey, I'm a Marine. I'm a comedian. I'll come perform for you guys anytime, any place for free, because, you know, I knew better than to try and get money from the United States Marine Corps. So I was like, yeah, I'll just come out any climb, any place. You know, that's, it's in the Marine Corps hymn, you know, wherever you guys are, I'll come. And Cinco de Mayo 2018, I got my first show for them. They hit me up. They were like, yo, we got your letter. We want you to come out. And I went alone. You know, now I bring a bunch of comedians with me, but I went alone as the first one. I was like, I don't know what to expect. This could be weird. This could be bad. Like, I'm just going to – it's a long drive. It might get canceled last minute. You know, the Marine Corps scheduling is weird. Things change, turn on a dime. So I was like, all right, let's just – let me go check it out. So I went, and I did 45 minutes for like 250 Marines. And they treated me like I was Dave Chappelle. They treated me like I was a star. They, like, loved me. And I was like, oh, wow, this is my crowd. This is what I'm supposed to be doing. These are my people. And it just snowballed from there. I spent the last 9 years going out to bases and doing shows for these guys. When I got back from Edinburgh in 2019... I had some money left over from the trip. I was actually supposed to go to New York after that, but my Airbnb canceled on me. So I had like a couple grand that I was like, you know what? I'm going to turn this into a nonprofit, because, you know, I wasn't charging for the shows. It's just easier to get shows for the military when you don't start trying to talk about budgeting and funding and blah, blah, blah. So I was like, if I turn it into a nonprofit, I can find like sponsors and donors, and it becomes like its own thing. So I turned it into a 501c3. We got approved to be a 501c3 the month the country shut down in April. So that was kind of a bummer launch. But it became this thing where it was like, not only did I, you know, it was in the beginning, it was like, I just want to get stage time. And, oh, these shows are fun. Like, these crowds are the best crowds in the world. But then it became like, I started realizing, like, this was bigger than that. You know, guys would come up to me after shows and be like, man, this was amazing, man. We needed this. We had like a rough week out in the field. You know, leaders would come up to me, like first sergeants would come up to me and be like, yo, man, you see those two Marines over there? They've been having trouble all week. They've been at each other's throats. Look at them now. You guys did this. Like, you guys were great, man. They would give me like letters of recommendation, talking really highly about everything we did. And I was like, this is incredible. Like, we are boosting morale. We are building camaraderie. We are promoting troop welfare. And that became our mission statement. You know, that's what we do now. We boost morale, build camaraderie, promote troop welfare. And the whole idea behind it is, you know, you just tell us when and where. That's it. That's the whole business model. I rent a van, I fill it with gas, I load it with comedians, and we drive out to wherever they are. It doesn't matter. We'll put a show on. I have all the gear. I don't need power. I don't need anything. I have everything. And it became like this really, it's really turned into so much more now. You know, it was something that was just about like developing myself and getting stage time, became this thing where, you know, we're affecting these young men and service women. We're building camaraderie. And then the comedians that I bring along too, these people that are my friends that are also working really hard trying to develop themselves, they get to experience what it's like to perform for the military. And then the van ride up and the van ride back, we're building camaraderie in the van, you know, we're boosting morale. Like, it's really hard to work out here in LA and to develop yourself. And when you get in a van with a bunch of comedians and you get on the road, it's a lot of fun. It's like spiritual almost, you know? And then I started to realize, like, After like, you know, it's very exciting. These shows are very exciting. And for the first couple of years, it was just like, oh man, it's just exciting. You don't have time to like process it. But once I finally like found my bearing in it, and it wasn't so overwhelming, I started to notice a lot of what was going on. And something even deeper is happening where, you know, I bring these comedians out and they're just my friends. They're just people who I think are funny that I see in LA that are developing themselves. I go, hey, man, you want to get in a van on Friday and go down and perform for 250 Marines?
That's but so cool.
What I realized was happening is I'm bringing people from all these different walks of life. You know, I'm bringing people out to perform for these young men and service women that they may have never gotten to experience. Like a lot of times when I start these shows, I go, who's been to a comedy club? 90% of the crowd has not. This is their first experience of watching stand-up comedy. And not only am I exposing them to stand-up comedy for the first time, but I'm exposing them to different cultures. Like, you know, whether it's a black comic or a gay comic or a trans comic, I'm bringing this art form to these young people and showing them, like, yo, it's okay to, like, think about these things that these people are talking about. Maybe they're thinking, maybe they're talking about things that you think about. You never would have thought that you could relate to this person, let alone laugh at some of the things they're talking about, you know? And it just became this bigger thing where I'm exposing these young men and service women to a culture that they may never have been able to experience without it, you know?
I think that's so, that must be so, it must just make you feel so good to be able to do this, because you know what it's like to be in the service, and then to be able to just have somebody transpose themselves for a while and not think about what they have to do and just actually enjoy themselves. It just sounds like an ideal situation for me, I would think.
Yeah, it's incredibly rewarding. It is so much fun. It's super fulfilling. And it's something I never thought I would be doing, or I never saw it coming. It all just kind of happened because I wanted to get better at stand-up.
So what does the future look like for your nonprofit? I mean, nonprofits are not easy to maintain. What's the future for the Rapid Fire Tour? What does it look like?
Well, this year is a big year.
Good.
Which leads me to, you know, this podcast here with you. My goal, the model has changed when it comes to like building a company or to, you know, spreading word. You know, whereas in the past you had to like get on a TV show or a talk show or spend a bunch of money on advertising. I think the new model now is in these platforms like radio shows, podcasts, you know, being able to go on and share the story with the viewers that these people have, like yourself. You know, you have people that tune in that are interested in learning new things, or they just enjoy you. And it's like, I'm now reaching out to all these people, whether they're military podcasts or just entertainment podcasts, being like, hey, this is what I do. I'm an entertainer. I'm also, you know, I run an organization, and I want to spread the word because a lot of people don't know about us. I mean, the way I get these shows is people get letters, you know, or someone that was at a show moves to a new unit and then they recommend us. And there's a lot of military people that don't even know that they could have something like this happen, that we'll come out and do a show for them for free. So I'm using this platform, these podcasts, this year to really spread the word. That's the goal this year, is to spread the word, let people know that we're out here and we want to do shows. And then also to spread the word to people who want to help. You know, a lot of people hear what we're up to and they're like, that's incredible. You know, I was a Marine, or my brother's a Marine, and I love stand-up comedy, I have friends and family in the military who struggled with, like, you know, the difficulties that are in the military, everything that comes with it. And I would love to help support, you know, boosting their morale. And, you know, people can go to the website and they can donate. People can sponsor us, things like that, whether you're a small business owner or you're just a person who wants to help put gas in the van. Because at the end of the day, our overhead is really low. You know, we rent a van, we fill it with gas. So it's like, you can go to our website and donate $5 and that puts gas in the van. Or, you know, if you're a business owner and you want to make a donation, that donation now can be like a tax deduction for your business, things like that. So my goal, really, the future is to put Rapid Fire in a position where there are more shows going on. Right now, you know, I might get, if I'm lucky, I get like 12 shows a year. They're kind of far and few between. But I'd love to be doing a show every weekend, you know, and that's why I got to spread the word and let people know that it's available, as well as being able to support this as a career for myself. You know, if I can find like big donors, big sponsors, if I can find big donors and big sponsors, then eventually I could just do this full time. I can just travel city to city and find veteran groups and organizations, not just active duty military, but, you know, groups of veterans that are in a city that are like, hey, you know, we go to the VFW up here. You know, we have like a Wednesday night thing that we do. We want you to come out and put on a show. It's like, if the organization has enough budget, I can, if Rapid Fire has enough money in its account, I can just come to that city and put on a show for free for them. And that's kind of my goal, is to build Rapid Fire to a point where I can just travel out to any group of military or first responder communities and put on a comedy show for them.
Oh, I feel my hand going over my heart, because your motivation is so loving and so respectful. And you understand what it's like to be in the military. And to bring some comedy to the military, I just think that's, I mean, my father was in the military. I understand what the military is like. And I just want to thank you and our friend Dave Turple, because he's the one that connected me to you, for, you know, getting this together so you could share what you do, Michael, because clearly you love what you do. It's obvious to anybody listening.
Yeah, I really do. I'm in love with the whole process of it, and I think that's kind of why I've gotten this far, and it gives me hope. It gives me hope for, like, what's possible in the future, because, you know, me and my friends talk about it a lot. Like, there's so many people doing comedy now, you know, it's become so popular, but I think a lot of people are just excited with the idea of comedy. But when you really love it, when you really, like, just love all of it, the process, you kind of like embed yourself in the future of it, you know. As it grows, so do I, and I'll never walk away from it, and I'll always be trying to make it better and make myself better in it.
Well, I'm sure you will, and I just want to thank you once again for sharing your story with us, because that's what gives me pleasure, and I'm delighted that you were able to have the time to talk about Rapid Fire Tour and your background and why you do it. So thank you again so much for being a guest on my show today.
Thank you for having me, Marcia.
Okay. Well, till next time, I'm going to have to check you out and come see you, Dave. I said Dave, Michael, so I have to come and see you, obviously. But till next time, everybody, bye for now.